Halt! Who goes there? Stand in the light and unfold yourself.
It is I, Macchizio, Duke of Mansfield. Long live the Huskies.
'Tis now struck 12. Get thee to bed, Macchizio.
In sooth, it is a strange thing to walk the moors of Stours and be so hammered. It comes from dawdling overmuch, lounging and drinking, tired to death. Sloth holds me in its iron clutch.
Then do not accost me, sir.
Good manager of the food court, bring forth a gammon of bacon and the curled macaroni of Naples. Add to it the heat of the jalapeno. It is pure air and fire, and the dull elements of earth and water never appear in it.
Peace, peace, Macchizio, peace. Thou talkest of nothing.
Nay, for Queen Herbst hath been with me. She is the fairy's food court manager, and she comes in shape no bigger than an elbow pasta on the fork of an alderman, drawn with a team of little cafeteria workers athwart men's noses as they lie asleep.
Pray, go on. Say more, Macchizio.
I would, for though I am not splenitive and rash, yet have I something in me dangerous, which let thy wisdom fear. Hold off thy hand, for now do I hurl the contents of my stomach.
Then away let us cut, for in yon glade the nose doth meet. Rude mechanicals gathered for an hour of talk. Of the Kennedys will they speak, and modernizations of the bard, and this knight of Macchizio, which is so foul and so fair. And now a churlish, scurvy, valiant canker blossom, whatever that means, Colin McEnroe.
Whatever that means indeed. So welcome to the news. Let me tell you who's on this week, and then I'll try to set things up for you. Legendary theater writer and critic Frank Rizzo from the Hartford Current is with us, making his first appearance on the news, making her not first appearance on the news. I think the person who was on the original first episode of the news, Irene Papoulis from Trinity College, and from Communication Strategies. I got it right this time. Patty McQueen. Yes, Communication Strategies is a communication firm that partners. No, I'm not going to read the whole description from the website.
Thanks.
But I did actually try to make sure I knew the name of the company this time. All right. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to begin, in fact, with this story of macaroni and cheese in the night in Yukon. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk about the Kennedys. The Kennedys kind of are, I think, American Shakespeare in some ways. And one generation of the Kennedy family right now is having a difference of opinion about the role that alcohol and post-traumatic stress syndrome and things like that have played in the forging of that family. And lastly, we will talk about a controversial proposal. It's not just a proposal. It's a commission by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival to translate all of Shakespeare's plays. I'm not sure translate is even the right word, but repurpose them anyway into a modern style of English, or maybe various modern styles of English, all of the plays. All right. But we're going to begin about a week ago or so at UConn, where a young man named Luke Gaddy, he's 19 years old, he did attain legendary status. There's a 9-minute video, which you probably have seen by now, because millions and millions of people have now seen it, and in which Luke Gaddy apparently drunk berates and shoves a UConn food court manager. And copies are just proliferating all over YouTube now, and it's all about his need for a bacon jalapeno mac and cheese. The problem is that he's got an open container of beer. He's not allowed to bring that into the college food court. It's late at night. This food court manager and his staff, eventually at wit's end, after he's shoved the food court manager a few times, they wrestle him to the floor and they hold him there until a cop shows up. And since then, the whole world has been watching this situation. The day after the story kind of broke, his family was there picking him up, taking him away. Not clear, I think, whether he's been expelled yet or not. But I have a lot of questions about this. But, you know, Irene Papoulis, you teach a college. Drunk college students aren't a rarity. They're not hard to find. Even drunk, obnoxious college students are not a rarity or hard to find. So what is it about this particular video? Why did it get 1.6 million views right away? Since then, by the way, the original video got taken down for reasons we don't quite understand. But there's another one up that has another 1.3 million and many other copies. I mean, really, five million people have probably seen this by now. So why is that happening? What are the elements in there that are kicking those tripwires?
Well, that's a good question. I just watched the whole video this morning. I mean, the other day I sort of watched it for like
just
2 seconds.
Highlights? Yeah.
Yeah. But this morning I watched the whole video. And the fact that it's a video is one thing. I mean, at one point he kind of I think it's his friend, right, who took the video. I'm not sure. It seemed like it wasn't just a bystander. So at one point he looks at the camera with sort of a sheepish grin towards the beginning. And it's sort of like, hey, you know, you're. And then the guy who's filming is saying, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. So I feel like part of it is just see how much this kid is going to do, and he's performing. I mean, he's kind of acting for the camera and for all of us. So we oblige by wanting to watch it.
Yeah, I think this is not known, but the much deeper than necessary and or as much deeper than would be good for me research that I've done about this suggests to me that maybe the person making the video works at that location. This is based on some tweets, the always reliable tweets. You know, I mean, if you want to get to the bottom of anything, obviously read tweets. But I think I might be right about this, that he works at this location. But I agree, he's playing to the camera. So that's one thing.
Yeah, and it's actually fascinating the way it develops, too, because the guy, the worker seems so, the manager seems so unflappable at first, mm-hmm. and he's just talking in a very rational, calm way, you know, you can't do it. But then all of a sudden, towards the end, he just completely loses it, when he gets shoved, which is understandable, mm-hmm. but it's sort of, though, his anger and animosity has been building up, which I can relate to as a teacher of every once in a while there are students like that. It's rare, but who won't let go, you know, and so that can be very frustrating to somebody whom they won't let go of.
Although, and we're going to have the theater critic go last here, but the dramatis persona kind of builds up. There's two women who work there who say, out, out, get out. And then eventually the person who really does get mad and take him down is a chef who works for him who says, you can't treat my boss like that, and takes him down in what we believe to be a full Nelson move, not legal in most forms of wrestling. So,
and we have to say, you know, that he's a white guy, and if he had been an African-American guy, it would have been a different kind of video and a different kind of story, perhaps. And so I just think that's important to note, because we maybe feel, you know, a lot of people feel more sympathetic to him.
So one of the themes that will come up,
white
Patty,
people, that is,
as we're talking about later when we're talking about the Kennedys, I think we'll say the same thing, which is people can see the same situation and read it different ways and have very different reactions to it. So the most common reaction to this has been that this guy is just really, really, really obnoxious in a way that's kind of amusing, especially because he kind of gets what's coming to him at the end. Is that the way it looks to you?
Well, I kept watching it, waiting for him to get what was coming to him. It's about the only reason I got to 9 minutes was like, come on, when is this going to happen? And the other thing that struck me was, as you watch it, you can hear all the kids around reacting. Every once in a while, even they are stunned at what this kid has said. You hear some oohs and, oh, my God, oh, my God. The moment that absolutely struck me was when he turned and he realized that he was being recorded, and he got that ridiculous smile on his face that just – and it was like, you know – and then he turned to the guy, and that was when he started poking him in the head and saying, you're going to look like a tool. Mm-hmm. I mean, sort of breathtaking. And it sort of locks
why
in.
Why breathtaking?
Because this guy just he's much calmer. The manager is more calm than this kid deserves under any circumstance. Mm-hmm. He's holding him off and holding him off and holding him off. And with every time this kid gets more arrogant, I'm just waiting for the cops to show up with the handcuffs. And really, it's the only reason I made it to 9 minutes.
Well, Frank Rizzo, Nico Muhly is probably turning this into an opera right now that you'll have to review at some point, the Ballad of Luke Gatti. But so what do you see in all this?
Well, I see an actor who comes alive once the green light is on. So once the kid sees that he's part of a show, he ramps it up a bit and decides to make this into the longest soliloquy I've ever heard on stage. but I was fascinated by the people around him and the reactions to the people around him. Here's a situation that is clearly potentially escalating, and despite Susan Herbst's reach out to college president of civility at UConn, here is a potentially volatile situation that no one is trying to arrest, but only sort of feeding into by getting out their cell phones to record. So it becomes this sort of fake reality. And besides being a jerk and wearing white socks with sandals, who does that? it's sort of a little bit of a freak show.
Which he worries about when he at the end there, oh, when really? He, oh, my God, where
are
my shoes?
He wants to know where his shoes are. He's very concerned
about
his shoes.
That's more important than the fact that he's just gotten arrested.
Handcuffed.
Yes, and handcuffed.
But it's just Luke being Luke, you know?
And I sort of wonder about that, too. First of all, I was watching this, and I had similar reactions to all of you. But I also thought there's something else going on here because at a certain point, he knows what it is that he wants. It's what all of you have said, that this has to end a certain way. And we know that he's been through – like I've never been thrown to the ground and cuffed. But he has already before this. He knows exactly how this is going to end, and he's not going to stop until it ends that way. Now, either that's the case because, as Frank is suggesting, you know, he's a performer, that everybody's a performer now. Increasingly, in this age where people whip out their cell phone cameras, people perform. It's either that or it struck me, actually, and then I sort of got sadder about this whole thing, that there's something else going on, that he's in some bizarre duel with his father or some other authority figure, whoever it is who's going to come to pick him up and bear some of the shame of this, and that he was up at University of Massachusetts last year. He did essentially the same thing twice in one month, in the month of September up there. So he knows how this goes.
But
yeah.
That's the subtext, Colin. You're going for the subtext instead of just treating it as a drunken kid who's dying to get macaroni and cheese. Now, if this was tofu, would it get the same amount of hits? Everyone likes macaroni and cheese. But in terms of feeding into it, I think as viewers, we are sort of, you know, trying to project who is this kid? What's going on? Why is he doing it? In 30 years earlier, he probably was a Kennedy.
Well, oof. What he's saying is really interesting. I mean, in the sense also that I'm aware as I'm watching this of several all kinds of sets of reactions I'm having. You know, it's customary these days for these YouTube videos to be annotated sometimes. And if I were annotating this, I would say, you know, I mean, at the beginning, I'm thinking, well, you know, jalapeno and bacon macaroni and cheese sounds pretty good, actually. I've never had that before. But the fact that he even thinks that this exists and he can have it, which some current researchers went out there and found out that's not strictly true. You kind of have to go over to the salad bar or the toppings bar and get the jalapeno and bacon yourself and mix it into the macaroni and cheese. But so that was my first reaction, too. I think Frank's right. If what he wanted was a turkey sandwich, it wouldn't be quite as viral as it is. There's something about him wanting this particular thing that's both a comfort food and then an exotic version of it.
Well, in minute four, I was sort of getting kind of peckish, you know, where I sort of – my mind drifted more to the macaroni and cheese than this tedious, you know, repetitive – rant that he was on.
Well, yeah, and that's interesting. I mean, in a way, it's also a Rorschach test, and that's part of why so many people want to watch it, because I watch it as the mother of a 19-year-old also. And so part of me thinks, oh, the poor kid. You know, he's just a lost kid.
Yep.
And, you know, they should just let him, he should just get out of there. Why can't he just, with one little turn of the thing, maybe he could just get out and he'd be okay. And maybe somebody could talk to him about how he feels and, you know, make him some macaroni and cheese somewhere else or whatever.
He spits in the face of the manager on the way out the door in handcuffs. I was actually just on the verge of feeling kind of bad for him. And then he did that.
He's not going to let you do this. And I think Frank is right. It's unclear whether this is Eugene O'Neill or Farrelly Brothers. It's one or the other. I'm seeing the Eugene O'Neill, the sort of overthrow of everything, you know, and the problems with the father. And then I think you're right, too, that the perspective from which you watch this is really says a lot about you and says a lot about how you'll react to this. By the way, we're not going to be talking about this too much longer. So actually, the best thing you could do would be to tweet about it, at WNPR Colin. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Twitter, at WNPR Colin. I'm sure you've all been following this drama. So I may have been the only person here, but I was sort of having this kind of Harrison Ford in Witness reaction where slowly I could feel my own hand clenching up a little bit, like in my arm tensing a little bit. Like I suddenly was the manager thinking about punching this kid. And I was really sort of fighting that too. You know?
But for good drama, you have to have a third element. And that would be one of those friends of his, one of those on watchers who steps up. And
they
perhaps,
try. They try.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the kid that comes in and he tries before the chef with his hair askew comes in and
but it wasn't,
with the full
it wasn't fully developed.
Anyway, if you watch Shakespeare, you know it's a bad idea to be Mercutio. If you step between them, you know you're the one who doesn't walk out of it. So we're going to take a break pretty soon. I will say one thing. You know, one of you I think used that sort of Lost Boys thing, and that's what I see there too. And I sort of see, maybe I'm reading way too much, but I feel like this kid is just another version of kids who are boys who are kind of lost in this jock culture, drinking culture. He's actually a competitive skier who was expected to ski for UConn. A jock culture, a drinking culture, and kind of like a culture in which they don't fit in all that well. You know, there's no real clear role for them. And a lot of times it ends even worse than this.
That's one end of the spectrum, and the other one is, you know, the white kid that thinks that whatever he wants he should get, you know, so...
Or if it was a young woman instead, would we have this sympathy to the lost girl?
No.
We would call her awful names.
And I also think – I think that there – somebody somewhere along the way said something about Trump. And I think, you know, not to trivialize it, I do think that Trump appeals to this really base and awful thing in a lot of people. And I think that's what you see in this kid. You see – I mean, the whole issue with the manager sort of poking fun at him because he's a lesser human being is so offensive, and that comes from somewhere. Somebody feeds into that and has let this kid know that that's okay.
The littlest Trump. All right, so that's like that's the holiday
movie. Yes.
Yeah, that's the movie. All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more after this.
But every boy's made me mac and cheese. Has always turned out to be a violent sociopath.
All right, we're back with The Nose. Patty McQueen is with us, as Irene Papoulos, and Frank Rizzo is being on The Nose for the first time. Very exciting for us as well, as I hope for him, maybe. All right, so this week, the Kennedy family, you know, one of the things I was thinking about in compiling even the panel that I compiled today is, you know, you like Rebecca Castellani, I think, is our youngest Nose panelist, and I thought, no, it's got to be people who basically sort of have lived with this whole Kennedy story and have the relationship that they have. So Patrick Kennedy, a former Rhode Island congressman. He's 48 years old. He's opening up in a whole new way, he says, about the Kennedy's family struggle with mental illness and addiction. He's got a new memoir. It's called A Common Struggle. And as he began doing interviews about it and talking about the fact – about the role that alcohol played in the family, although that's not exactly news and about the idea that he thought his father had post-traumatic stress syndrome, that it was kind of passed on to his sister and brother and himself. Suddenly, we started hearing from other members of the family, and especially Ted Jr., whom some of us here in the studio know, said on Sunday that he was heartbroken that Patrick had written what he called an inaccurate and unfair portrayal of their family. He said that the narrative was misleading and hurtful. Other members of the family have had their own sort of differences with this story. So Patty McQueen, as somebody who spent an awful lot of time in the political sphere and probably knows one or two of these people, you know, this is the kind of thing that ordinarily doesn't get debated in public. And I guess Patrick's point is, well, that's the problem.
Right.
It doesn't get
right.
debated in public.
Yeah. Right. And I think, you know, that's what I hear him saying, is that in order for him to heal and in order for him to sort of pay it forward, that what he needs to do is lay it all out. And the you know, it's very brave of him to do this. It's a little bit dangerous because for people in recovery, I think any time you sort of lay it out there that I'm clean and sober, you put more pressure on yourself to stay clean and sober. So that's an issue he just has to deal with in this. But it's pretty brave to take on that machine that we've all seen all of our lives. And what's interesting to me is that even the pushback from the family, the truth is that all of those things could be true. I mean, you could be disappointed that he's telling this story, but it could still be true. And it could be hurtful, but it could still be true. So, and nobody's really said anything that pokes a hole in it. What they've said is how it feels. And I understand all of that, but I think for the issue of substance abuse and mental health treatment, it's a huge gift in a way to sort of put it in the headlines in a healthier way.
You know, not to pigeonhole you as a theater critic, Frank Rizzo, but you know, things happen on stage because they need to be on stage, because people need them to be on stage. So we're back to Eugene O'Neill, you know, sort of bringing these things forward. On the other hand, one thing, you know, Ted Kennedy Jr. is the first Kennedy I've ever really met, and I even know him a tiny bit. Like, the next time I see him, we could continue a conversation we had before. And it's the first time I realized these people weren't Shakespearean players, you know, that they actually are real people.
No, they're very human. I've been thinking about this from a theatrical point of view, and I come down on as everyone has their own story. Everyone has the right to their own story. There's not a family story that only one person in that family can tell. And for all of these people, their stories are the true stories from their perspective and their point of view. And certainly this is his. I'm sure Donald Trump wants to control his family's story and his story, but he has kids. Everyone has kids. Everyone has parents. Eugene O'Neill's kids, they all have family connections, and they all have stories. Some stories are better than others, but I think they all have a right to tell it the way that they want to tell it.
Yes, go ahead.
I just think it's amazing how, you know, Ted Kennedy was so abnormal, but he was so normal too, you know. And even the words that that Patrick used of, like, you know, the unprocessed emotions that he felt, you know. And so just that whole theme and that whole idea which I find very interesting in general, is that if you don't feel something, you're going to be trapped until you really feel it, you know. In a way, it seems so counterintuitive as a concept, you know. It's like, can't you
really
just,
that seems counterintuitive.
Well,
to
it
you?
Seems intellectually it does, not personally and emotionally. Mm. I think it's absolutely true, but at the same time, I think, can't you just put it away? Can't you just say, yeah, this happened in the past, but it's over now, so no big deal.
Well,
it
depends on
that.
Who you're talking about, because I mean, to me, one of the things that that's happening here is there is kind of a smashing or an attempt to smash a kind of American myth, which is stoically going forward, you know. And it's a myth basically that the Kennedy family promulgated for whatever reason, for their own sake, for the country's sake. You know, the story of Ted Kennedy Sr. was he had been through the worst possible things, you know, the assassinations of two of his brothers. Then there was that 1980 campaign, Patty McQueen, where he ran, and it was just so clear, you know, his ambivalence about this, you know, was A, so completely understandable, so clear to a lot of other people besides him, you know. And so to have his son say, you know, he had post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right.
To me, that's sort of liberating. Like, why did we have to pretend that someone could just sort of boldly go forward after this?
See, I think it's interesting that you say that, because I'm not sure we ever pretended. I mean, I think that Ted Kennedy has always sort of been flawed, and we came to accept him for being that flawed. I mean, there was Chappaquiddick, and he was forgiven for, you know, some pretty unforgivable stuff there. For lots of reasons that we don't need to get into all the details of, but there were lots of things that happened to him along the way, and somehow he survived them. So it's you know, the fact that someone would say that his son would say that he had post-traumatic stress, is like, of course he did.
Right, but he was Ted Kennedy, so he was supposed to be different. I know he wasn't.
But what I'm saying is, I don't think that it's – I mean, it's not a surprise that he wasn't. I think we all knew he wasn't, and we all knew he was kind of broken, and that's part of what made him so great, is that he picked himself up and he kept on going. Well, I think you can be broken and keep going and still not be – you know, impervious.
But I agree that we knew he was broken, but I think we sort of thought he was handling it. At least I did. Or, you know, I think we thought, well, yeah, but he's Ted Kennedy. So, yeah, he's got all those things, but he's handling it because he's a great man, let's say.
I think it goes back to Frank's point, too, that in some ways two stories can be true at the same time. And so with the Kennedys, there's one story that they are held to impossible standards. Yeah. And then the other story is excuses and cover-ups for them go on all the time, so that starting with Jack and going forward, so that maybe you do get a William Kennedy Smith, you get a Chappaquiddick, that both of those things are true. They have to behave behave incredibly heroically, but over the course of that, there's sort of a corruption of them that goes on too. And maybe, I don't know, this, I wouldn't want to be this generation of Kennedys because they're, I think, trying to synthesize all this and trying to figure it all out.
Well, they've got all the bad without all the good. You know, and I mean that in the nicest way, that they don't, you know, those sort of glory days of JFK and Bobby are behind them, and now they're dealing with all of this fallout without any of that.
I think the second generation has a different perspective, a different point of view, and a different sensibility of how to handle things, but everyone is different.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this up because some very nice people are going to come and ask you to support not only this radio station but this radio show. So please do that. Think about doing that. The nice people will be saying nice things about us, ideally. I don't really even know who's in the booth right now. But whether they do or not, support the radio station because it really helps this show. Helps this show if you make your pledge right now. We'll be back with more of Patty McQueen, Frank Rizzo, and Irene Papoulis after the proverbial this.
Working on a translation of the Dick and Jane books into Shakespearean English. Thrice now the brindled cat Puff hath mewed. Jane hath said, "Here, Puff, cometh hither." "Look," hath said Jane. "Look hither, Puff." Jane hath said, "Puff, Puff, behold at this. Come hither and behold at this." Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolfe, with help from Lydia Brown. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Sarah Flaherty. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kevin McCarthy. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff making B&J, M&C with A&T and F&M, I'm just making stuff up now, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday's show, The Scramble looks at the shabby world of fantasy football. And now, back to Colin.
By one reckoning, 60,000 commercials for FanDuel and the other one have now, Fantasy King, have now run in this 1 year alone. And now it's all being revealed as a terrible, scabby, shabby sham. So that'll be part of Monday's show. We'll be doing other stuff as well. All right. We're back with Frank Rizzo, theater writer and critic for the Hartford Current, and Patty McQueen from Communication Strategies, and from Trinity College, Irene Papoulis. So we're going to definitely need our theater critic and our English professor for this segment. I'm going to just read the introduction to the New Yorker's latest posting about this rather than make up my own. Last week, the Oregon Theater Shakespeare Festival announced that it had commissioned 36 playwrights to translate all of Shakespeare's plays into modern English. The backlash began immediately, with OSF, that's the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, devotees posting their laments on the festival's Facebook page. What a revolting development. Is there really a need to translate English into brain-dead American? And why not just rewrite Shakespeare in emoticons and text acronyms? Asterisk, somebody is probably doing that. Beneath the opprobrium lay a shared assumption that Shakespeare's genius inheres not in his complicated characters or carefully orchestrated scenes or subtle ideas, but in the singularity of his words. So I guess I will start with the theater critic. Well, I mean, Shakespeare gets monkeyed with all the time,
all
right?
All the time. And in the 18th century, completely rewritten. No sniff of Shakespeare there. I mean, they just changed everything willy-nilly. In fact, they changed his name to willy-nilly.
Or Milli Vanilli, I think it might have been.
But so it's nothing new. It's this approach of changing just the language and nothing else, not the setting, not the time period, and using contemporary writers to do it. My gut reaction was the eyeball roll. And the cheap jokes, you know, Harold Bloom is in the ICU unit at Yale New Haven Hospital because Harold is one of the world's greatest scholars of Shakespeare.
We'd like to emphasize that Harold is, to the best of our knowledge, not right now, although he's getting on in years. But
I imagine that this is not one of his favorite initiatives. However, this is being done by a man that I respect greatly in the theater. In fact, I saw him last night at Paula Vogel's opening, Bill Rausch, who has done amazing things at the Oregon Shakespeare Theater. And I'm intrigued by the project and would be interested to see where it goes. So I've held back on my sense of mockery. And the more I think about it, the more I read the New Yorker article, the more I think there's more to it than that. I just sort of, like I said earlier, wish maybe they didn't have to embrace all 36 at once. And I wonder who gets the short straw for two noble kingsmen.
Right. So one of the people not pleased with this is the Shakespeare scholar James Shapiro of Columbia. He's actually been on this show. He was on the show we did about Hamlet last year. He's not happy about this and feels that all kinds of subtleties are going to be vacuumed out. Irene, as a teacher, you've got to be a little bit worried about this. I mean, we live in an age anyway where the first thing everybody does, I think, from what I can tell, is go online and look for the electronic versions of the Cliff Notes to everything. I mean, they don't want to wrestle with all this stuff. I mean, at least maybe nobody's ever wanted to wrestle with it. But this sort of plays into a desire that people, especially young people, may have.
Absolutely. And I don't like that desire because I think reading difficult texts is really important and also listening to them in the theater. But I forgot to look it up, but there was an op-ed in the Times recently about this issue saying that the acting really has a huge effect on how people perceive Shakespeare's words, you know, and I think that's so true. When I think of the Hamlet that we had at the
yes.
Hartford stage last year, he was so good. You never for a minute said, what is he talking
exactly.
about?
Exactly.
Because he was so good at acting. And so, it's because he really understood the words, you know, and everyone's seen a high school Shakespeare production where the kids have no idea what they're talking about, but they've memorized everything. And it's just complete gibberish, you know. So part of it is, you know, I feel like the training of actors and making sure that the actors live the language is also part of what does this. And at the same time, I think in the classroom, it's the same thing because so many teachers said, or at least when I was in high school, the teacher would say, go home and read this, you know, and everybody would say, what? I can't read this. This doesn't make any sense, you know. But there's been so much work, like Shakespeare and Company and Lenox Mass does these wonderful workshops for teachers and students. And I've played around with that myself in some classes where you have students act the language out and understand it that way, you know. And so working with, because I think there is a problem, a crisis of reading in our culture, but part of the problem is students who don't know how to read aren't really taught how to read. And there are ways that you actually can teach students how to read, and Shakespeare's language is beautiful for that.
So, Patty McQueen, I think I infected you with the schmoop virus earlier today. So, because, I mean, in this church that I go to, we're reading the Book of Mark, and I was inviting occasional nose panelist Jim Chapdelaine to come to church with me, and he showed me schmoop, where they take the Book of Mark, and they, in very sort of jocular, vernacular ways, they don't even translate it. They just sort of tell you what they think is going on.
It's the Cliff Notes,
but it's also kind of interestingly interpretive and contextualizing, and it's flip, and it's irreverent, and it's sacrilegious, but it's also, I found it actually pretty useful. But we don't want to, I mean, and maybe you could say that about this too, that it's the schmooping of Shakespeare. But if that's a gateway into Shakespeare,
You know, it's interesting because my initial response is, you know, to not like the idea. In part because, you know, when I was a kid, and my parents used to get tickets to the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford. And, you know, we were little kids, and we would drive down to see these Shakespeare plays, and my mother would read aloud on the way to the play. So we would – and she would sort of go through what was in the play with us so we would understand what was happening. And again, you know, who understood the language? It didn't make any – it was like – it was gobbledygook, except when she would explain it all, and then we'd go watch it, and there were these people in these great costumes, and they were doing classical Shakespeare, and it was fabulous. And I think, you know, Shakespeare is sort of the greatest challenge in theater. And I don't know. I just don't know why you would ruin it.
Well, the instructions for this project is very, very specific. It's not to cut, not to edit, and not to add any personal politics. It's just to clarify, and not to do anything crazy with it. Now, I understand that part, and I'm going to wait and see. But on the other hand,
translation is inherently
And I agree, because
subjective.
I keep going back to what I call the whoosh of experience, where you're watching Shakespeare done and you're in the middle of a scene and you don't know what the heck is happening on stage. But you're writing the words like you're writing A Surfer Rides the Wave. You're just writing it. You don't know exactly what's going on. And then suddenly there's a moment of revelation. And you don't get that any other way other than just sort of somehow it breaks through and suddenly you get it. And certainly it's helped by good acting and good stage direction. But sometimes it's just happens on the wave all by yourself. And that's an extraordinary experience that you wouldn't get if everything is spelled out for you. So, again, I'm a divided man here.
That's a great way to put it. I think that's really true. And I agree with you.
But on the other hand, we can be helped by various things. I would totally second Irene's emotion that the Darko Trejnik version of Hamlet. I was never in any doubt about what was being said, and Hamlet can be confusing at moments, and it just wasn't. I don't know what the trick was there, but it wasn't. Everything was spoken in a way that made it.
It's called acting.
Yeah, but there are good actors who can't do that. There was some way in which this was really done in an incredibly helpful way. But I guess the other thing that I would maybe even like to sort of end with as we get ready for our endorsements, we'll have a lot of time for endorsements, but that's a good thing. Is that, you know, you don't want to lose track of this language because it is our language. You know, I mean, if you just go through Hamlet for every single phrase or trope that just made it into the English language that we use. I mean, you just don't get through a day probably without using something.
Like Ben Carson saying last night, he said it was much to do about nothing.
All right. Well, people don't always get it right.
Yeah.
So let's do endorsements right now. We'll let Frank go last so he can pick up the little drift of it. So, Irene, what have you got to endorse?
I have to endorse a restaurant called Shu Restaurant. Have you been there? S-H-U?
Nope.
Chinese restaurant. It is incredibly delicious and amazing.
The locality?
And the locality is on New Britain Avenue. It's right actually in the same plaza where Faux Boston is and the Adang supermarket.
So near the Hartford, West Hartford line.
Near the West Hartford line across. And it's just authentic Chinese. Somebody told me that it was authentic Chinese food and I didn't really believe it until I went there. And it's just, you know, the 7 flavored wonton appetizers is amazing.
Wow.
I highly recommend it.
You had me at 7 flavored wonton appetizer. All right. What have you got, Patty McGuire?
Mine's actually an old endorsement. And over the last week or so, I've had the reason to be looking back at the at Funny Girl and between the Broadway soundtrack and the movie, and I'm sort of blown away anew by how great Barbara Streisand was. I mean, she's sort of become something else in her later years, and I'm not sure she ever repeated that performance in anything else she did, but some of that music just still gives me chills when I hear it, and it's just worth going back and listening to again. She's marvelous.
I was thinking about Barbara Streisand earlier this week. All right, so Frank Rizzo, you see everything.
And to segue, that was my first Broadway show that I saw. I actually saw Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl.
Lucky. Yeah. One of the few performances she actually did.
Yes, I got that. My recommendation is a show I saw last night at Yale Repertory Theater called Paula Vogel. The play is called Indecent. It's a transformative play. It's so theatrical, so interesting. And my review should be hitting the internet at ctnow.com any minute now. But you can probably have gleaned that I liked it very, very much. And I think everyone should go see it.
So this is a play about a play. It's a play about a play that was staged originally in 1906, 1907, and then moved to Broadway, I think, in 1923,
mm-hmm.
Whereupon it was moving out of the Yiddish theater and into the Broadway stage. But it's about prostitutes. It's about a lesbian love affair. And it got everybody arrested, basically.
No, it's real. With this, Paula's show is really about the transformative act of theater, and it's thrilling.
All right, I'm going to endorse – I'm going to go lowbrow compared to all of this, I think, and endorse something on television. All right, so last year on HBO, The Leftovers, based on the Tom Perrotta novel, I didn't particularly like, but I've liked it enough to kind of stay with it and watch the first episode this year. And they really have repurposed the show right down to the opening title credits there. Everything's different. The cast is radically different. Regina King, who I would just endorse in anything, is going to have a big role this year on The Leftovers. And the first episode was riveting, absolutely riveting. Could not take my eyes off it. And I want to particularly mention a young African-American – no, he's not a young African-American actor, but young enough. A guy named Kevin Carroll, who I didn't know, I've never seen before, and he was remarkable. I will predict great things for him. I also want to quickly mention Saturday night, Nightfall, 8 p.m. – no, 6 p.m. 6 p.m. at Keeney Park in Hartford. This is as creative and wild and crazy and multidisciplinary as Hartford ever gets. This is the genius of Ann Coverley. Our own Kyone Wolf is in it. You ought to go see it. Don't worry. You'll be safe. I know it's Keeney Park. You're nervous. Don't be nervous. Go see Nightfall.
Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Along the rail.